Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in.
I want to do bad things with you.
Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series bite by bite.
This week, we take a stroll down memory lane as we share all our favorite moments and behind-the-scenes stories from the fourth season.
Plus, werewolves and witches and fairies. Oh, my.
Oh, my.
Where did all these fantastic creatures begin in our cultural imagination? The true story just might be stranger than fiction. So, Deb, you and I have had some sleepless nights watching season four,
cramming. 12 hours.
Yeah, 12 hours cramming for today to discuss all of season four, which is a lot.
It's a lot.
And I'm so curious because, as we've said, you and I didn't watch the show as it was airing. So I can't wait to hear what you thought of season four.
Same. Same, honestly. So I have kind of a controversial take here.
Whoa, what?
As far as I understand,
okay,
season four is not maybe like the highest ranking season out there in the populace.
Oh.
I'm going to go out and say this is my favorite season of True Blood so far.
Okay, Deb.
I know, mic drop.
What? Mic drop. I have had a whole conversation with myself for the last 12 hours thinking how much I was enjoying the season, and I could not figure out if it was me enjoying watching me more, right?
Well, that is an enormous factor in my decision, Kristen.
Is it?
It's an enormous factor in my decision.
It is.
So I have a theory on why this is my favorite. I do think that people, it could be that writers and actors are finding their groove, right? Like, I do think we are seeing each performer do the thing that they do best.
100%.
They're doing it really well. They're at peak, you know, capacity of their talent, you know, in that way for a lot of it. I will get into this. I think particularly Fiona Shaw and Paola Turbe doing this Marnie Antonia thing is just... it's just
amazing.
So fascinating to watch. I love the witch storyline.
I do too.
But I think above and beyond, the reason why this season sings for me is because we're all home. Mm. We're all in Bon Temps, right? We haven't split the cast
between
Bon Temps and Dallas or Bon Temps and Mississippi. Like, we are all at home dealing with the same essential storyline. You know, we all have separate little things, but our storylines are entwined, and it feels like everybody's getting more time. You know, it always felt like in the previous seasons, we had to spend so much time with the main storyline in another place that it meant the people in Bon Temps did not get the same kind of attention paid to their roles. And this season, because we're all home, we're seeing more of you. We're seeing more of Jessica Tux, Nan. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing more of Terry and Arlene. You know, it's just, I think, so smart. And this season really soars for me because we're all together.
That is such a good point when I think about that, because Tara comes back to town. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam has all his stuff at home. Everyone.
Yeah.
And it is tough in the beginning of a series because it will be based on the lead and her life and what centers around it. And it does take seasons to explore the rest of the cast.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I you've got a very good point, because we got to know everybody so much deeper.
Yeah. Now, you know, I don't think it's a perfect season. There are things that I like less or more, but I think as an overall, the feeling of it and the enjoyment that I got out of watching it is probably the highest so far. And interestingly, and we'll get into this as we share our personal reflections, it was maybe my favorite to film. I loved shooting season four. The stuff that I got to do as Jessica and the leaps that her character made was very exciting for me.
Yeah, I agree. You just took it up a whole nother notch, and the writing supported that. Your character so comes into her own. You know, she's finding her vampire sea legs.
Well, and you as well,
yeah,
right?
Like, right.
In a way, and, you know, the fact that Eric had amnesia kind of got you out of sidekick land, you know? Like,
totally.
Finally, I can't believe it took them four freaking years to figure out what a gold mine they had in Kristen Bauer as Pam. And finally, we're getting to see, you know, really what an asset you are to the show on a regular basis. So it's spectacular. We're going to embarrass each other, the pants
yeah, we
off
are.
Of each other
we
in
are.
A minute. But before we do that, let's embarrass some other people.
Okay, good.
Like I said, I want to start with Fiona Shaw and Paola Turbe as Marnie and Antonia. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm just every time they come on screen, I'm like, oh, what are they going to do now?
I know. They're so, what a tough, incredible role. Fiona Shaw is so brave and so good and so grounded. And I would be so intimidated. There's so much of this season with people playing other roles, right, in their body. And that's a challenge. I think that
you do imitations.
And to do that at home, you know, you work on it and work on it. But I just think of that moment when you're in your first take and you're on the set and they say action and you've got to now make the transition from being Marnie to Antonia, and you're going to find out on its feet if it's working while 50 people stare at you.
Yeah. I mean, from being Fiona to Marnie to Antonia and then back again,
you know,
in succession. So,
yeah, she's an English lady.
she's an English theater nerd, you know.
And now she's in Hollywood on this vampire show doing night shoots at Greer, pretending to be Marnie, pretending to be Antonia.
And it's so amazing. I mean, there's that scene where they do where her face morphs between Marnie and Antonia, you know, back and forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are two women who don't look anything alike particularly, but it is one, I want to give it to the visual arts department who did whatever CGI. It's so seamless.
Yeah.
And it's like they have the same eyes and they match perfectly in their intensity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then we have these flashbacks with Paola and her energy.
Oh, she's
so beautiful.
Oh my God,
I was just knocked out of my socks every time I saw her.
Yeah, I can't agree more.
To do so much with so little.
So much. She has a full story arc where she has almost like the Godric arc, right? So she goes from being vengeful to this is not who we are.
Yeah,
really
it is a Godric arc. And then I think to have Marnie counter that and be the peaceful, we just want to practice our religion, and then suddenly shift to like, ooh, power.
You know? Yeah, ooh, power, I want
such
more.
A great story. Yeah, because, you know, she had a couple of lines where she was like, you know, I was born with this oddity, this thing I can do, and why, and that idea of being sort of a freak or a strange, but I was like, oh, it's like Sookie, right? Mm-hmm. It's that similar space, and how different personalities choose to manage that, and you can see why someone who grew up feeling that way would get a taste of power and being the person on top and in control might really be intoxicating.
Yeah, the bullied becomes the bully.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And speaking of people who get to play other people,
right.
We have a lot of that going on this season. Lafayette, Nelson, gets to play a number of other people through his medium powers.
Yeah, he was had to play three different people distinctly.
I believe and different languages and accents.
And different, different languages, different accents. And tough situations, right? So in heartbreaking situations, being scared, he's just always, of course, going to be a marvel to watch do even the smallest moment. One moment that
I feel like such a broken clock, you know,
totally.
Talking about his work is just like, I have no more ways to say you are excellent. You know, like there's just the synonyms don't exist.
Right. Exactly. There aren't words to describe how sublimely bleh he is. You know what I mean? Like, what are the words? You know, there was a small moment. And I don't know, we kind of get used to these big moments being handled so adroitly, but it was when they were in the bathroom at Moon Goddess and Jesus was trying to use the corpse to, you know, do whatever he's going to do to get Antonio and Marnie separated. Mm. And Lafayette is watching this and taking instructions. So there's almost nothing for him to do. Right. And every moment and reaction I noticed as, wow.
Yeah.
He wasn't just
present.
He was just present and adding so much to okay, you know, would be his line. Yeah, just a master, an absolute unique, masterful human.
And then, of course, we had the Skinwalkers. Mm-hmm. So we have Sam Trammell, who is a remarkable mimic.
Remarkable.
Doing a spot on Marshall Tommy, you know. It's kind of creepy how well he does.
It was so spot on that then I started noticing Tommy more, right? Because you were like, oh my gosh, he does walk like that. It all of a sudden revealed Tommy to me. So that was absolutely phenomenal.
And even Dale Raul got a shot at being Tommy.
Yes.
As well. Which was so fun to see her fun. So
it was so fun, and it was such a cute detail that they screwed her hair up. Like, Tommy didn't quite know how to do her hair.
Yes, he doesn't know how to do her hair and makeup. Oh my God. Fantastic.
And then Kevin Alejandro became other things and creatures, right?
Yes, his demon face and,
I guess, I mean, I don't know if these things are in the books, because by this point I had stopped reading the books, but it does make me think that the writers, certainly nothing you did was in the books, and nothing Lafayette did was in the books, because he was dead by then. But it does make me think about what you were talking about with us being home and just getting to season four, that the writers now were inspiring each other in two directions.
Yes, yes.
Right, so they're getting to know us. They're writing for us. They're having fun. They know that we can do it.
Yeah.
And we've gotten into a really good relationship by season four.
Well, we've established characters that we can now subvert.
Yeah.
Which brings me right into Bill this season.
Yes.
Who's so exciting.
Yes.
The fact that, like, he's been four different people throughout this show, you know, the good boyfriend. Then he was working for working for Sophie Ann. And then we're like, we don't know who he's working for. Now he's been a vampire spy for the authority for at least 20, 30 years, right? And it's just so exciting. I love that idea. And so cool to see that flashback with Steven as a British punk, because we all know that's a lot closer to who Steven is than Bill ever will be.
Yeah, and we're piecing with these flashbacks, we get to piece together who these people are over a couple hundred years, right? So we had the Civil War version of Steven, of Bill, and now we've got, I love this punk guy with the 80s probably, you know, so fun.
And then to contrast that with politician, vampire, king. You know, ruthless leader king, like, whoa, interesting.
So interesting.
Yeah.
I think I wrote in my notes towards the beginning, oh, wow, he's like an asshole now, because he was so sweet, good, antithesis of the typical vampire. And he's just now king and owning it. comfortably.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's this contrast. So we have, you know, we see, because Bill is a sweet, soft person, right? I think he does genuinely feel for Sookie in that way. But that doesn't mean he can't have that ruthless, hard exterior. And similarly then with Eric, who we thought was all ruthless, hard exterior, now is revealed quite a soft heart with this amnesia. Once the kind of memory of all of his crimes is taken away, his pure essence can come forth.
They really flopped.
They flip-flopped. And I think the idea, you know, in the end, it ended up balancing them both, right? They're both less of an archetype and more of a three-dimensional person because of that.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, the sweet Alex that I know, who's so funny, I want him to just be doing romantic comedies, because this is the funniest guy. He's so witty, right? And so charming. And so I got to see a little bit more of that in him on the screen, which was really fun for me. And then also, maybe it's my sort of wounded self-esteem self or something, but I really liked when he became the bad boy again. It's just bad boys are sexy, right? So I liked that Bill got to be more of a bad boy. And then I liked when we had bad boy Eric back.
Well, and what's good is it because after the amnesia, you know, which was basically just a sexcapade for a few episodes there.
Yeah.
We just get a more well-rounded Eric, right? We get exactly who he was back, but we have deeper insight into who he is.
Right.
I think it served both characters this season to, you know, to subvert their archetypes a little bit.
Really, kudos to the writers, because a lot was going on and they still had these fabulous arcs in mind.
Yes. So they I think, again, because we were all at home, there's time for both plot and character.
So smart.
You know, not everything has to be plot. We have time to kind of interweave those. And, you know, the writers, I just think, found their stride. And one of the places they found their stride was with Pam Swinford de Beaufort. because I just, every time you were on screen, I was like, who is this incredible, like, woman who's, like, blossoming in front of us here? And it's just, again, similarly, to take what Pam had been, which was kind of a fun one-liner, you know, sidekick character. And now it's just so much more. They gave you so much more to play with.
Yeah.
And you just deliver every freaking second. And it's funny. And you're horrible, but I love you. I don't know. I can't gush enough.
That is so true. Pam is so horrible, and we love her so much.
So horrible.
She's horrible. And yet is doing and saying, I think, what most of us want to do, you know? Right? I think she's...
Well, but again, I think... It goes back to that conversation we had about villains, where, like, it isn't just the boundary pushing of being a villain. It's a boundary pushing of just society and tradition, right? Like, it is. It's being able to say what everyone is thinking but is too polite or traditional or stuck in their ways to say.
Yes.
So there's so much freedom and fun in that, and we get to live vicariously through you.
Yeah, I agree, and I got to live vicariously through her, and I really loved so much having my own storyline. And the fact that there was also this prosthetics.
Despite the horrible prosthetic work.
And it's challenging. It's freaking challenging. You know, it's many hours where, you know, and then you start work at 6 a.m., you know. And it's challenging, and I couldn't see out of one eye, which is actually totally bizarre. I would not know where my scene partner was. I realized why there's a two-eye system. And And, like, one time they were, you know, I think it was in that scene with Alex where we're in prison, and he's like, what smells?
It's me.
It's me. She's like, under the sheet. There was a lot of humor in it, too. There was one line.
You take it off, and then he goes, oh. It's so deadpan and small, but it's so good.
It's so deadpan and small.
Well, I just want to give a huge shout out to the special effects prosthetics team, because they are in close up. On you in that prosthetic.
Yeah.
They are way in tight there. There's no blurry, you know, that had to be spot on, and you had to manipulate it. You had to put your fingers in it and talk and blink and what a job they did.
It was an incredible, incredible job, and we had to do it multiple times, so there was huge continuity. So they had made multiple pieces, right? And every time would be often a different makeup artist from Masters FX doing it. But I even had a mouthpiece inside with a piece of fabric attached to it that went down, which came out of my mouth, at the corner of my mouth, and wrapped around under my jaw and was glued to my neck to pull half my face down. So there was, right? So it was really intensely designed, and it had to progress.
Yeah.
Right? She kept rotting. So.
And then they came up with magical juice to inject into you so you didn't have to wear it anymore.
Yes!
Which is very nice of them.
Which was very nice of them. But I also love that in between, like, they rip the skin off, whole nother look. Then I'm the fetus, right, in the coffin.
Yes.
So it was absolutely fascinating to be part of that process.
Yeah. Well, I have to say also, without being too shallow about it, even with all the rotting, you're very, very sexy, I have to say.
Really?
You don't lose an ounce of your hotness beneath all of the yuck.
I noticed that I was like doing my hand on the hip and my hip out and stuff. So I was still maintaining my sexiness like throughout.
It was all still there. Because I also had to wear some yuck quite a bit this season because of all the silvering and then walking into the sun. And I remember when I was at Masters FX and they were putting on the burn and stuff on my face, and they started with the lightest and we took a picture of that and then like progressively went so that they could show, you know, where do you want this to live to the writers, directors. And I remember taking a picture at one point to send to my boyfriend, just being like, would you still make out with me? Because I knew I had to kiss Jason. And I was like, we can't go so far.
Right.
That you wouldn't want to kiss this person, but it should still look gross. So that was like our barometers. Would my boyfriend, my actual boyfriend, still make out with me?
Right? Like, also, in return, was absolutely loving everything you did. The breakup, the arc of like fighting who this vampire person is now, and then giving into it, feeling bad about it, glamoring Hoyt because you were like, "Ooh, I heard him. Oh my God,
dark.
I heard him. I heard him."
Yeah, it's so dark. But who among us can say we wouldn't be tempted by that, right?
Oh, I think most people, given that power, would not be able to not use it.
And she's
right,
18 at this point, maybe, you know?
Oh, like, right. Ooh. Right.
In terms of her, like, mental development, psychological development. Yeah, I think it was fascinating, you know, the breakup with Hoyt, a couple of interesting things that I remember is I remember Alan Ball called me into his office before the season to say, hey, I know that you and Jim are very attached to this storyline, and I want to let you know that this season we're going to be breaking them up and, you know, having some other stuff come in. And I just thought that was so classy and
cool of him
to not just let me be surprised by it, but to kind of let me in on the process and why they were thinking of doing this and how, you know, how it was going to work. And just that the respect that he had for me and Jim and Ryan to know that like actors get attached to these things.
Wow.
And I was really floored by that. And again, Never since then have I had a showrunner put in that kind of effort, you know, to care for me that way. This is not totally true. I'm going to give Eric Olson a shout out here and say he is also a spectacular showrunner.
Okay.
But that was very, very cool of Alan, I thought.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I had a showrunner that ever... I'm like, no, I just can't think of anyone that could come close to Alan Ball. And there's other people I've heard that he did that for. We'll talk about in season five. But
yeah,
it's really unique.
Yeah. Going into those scenes with Hoyt, it was good. It was one good for me to know because I went back and really thought a lot about where Jessica was coming from and the abuse she had suffered at home before being made a vampire and thinking about how when you're with someone who, even though they love you, kicks the wall, throws things, you know, and I don't think Hoyt, you know, is like her father, but that kind of behavior lands differently on you when that's your experience.
Yes.
And I remember doing a lot of research at the time and really thinking about how powerless and infantilizing that feels when you're recognizing behavior from your parent in your partner.
Right.
Even if they're not going to that extent, it's just, it's a different experience.
Yes.
And, you know, she was with, you know, under the reign of the tyranny of her father, then got made and was controlled by Bill, then hooked up with Hoyt and has been living with Hoyt. So Jessica has not been herself. She's not had an opportunity to figure out who she is on her own. And I think all of the things that they wrote for me to say to him are true. It doesn't mean they're not hurtful,
right?
But they're true. We move too fast. We're each other's first real relationship. We moved in together. You want, obviously, to have kids and be out in the sun and have these things, and that's not something I can do, you know? And so I think she's, just because you love someone doesn't mean it's going to work.
Yeah.
And that is the very, very sad truth, I think.
Yeah.
And
the writing really was great. And you guys pulled it off so great because I'm thinking about how that goes down and how his reaction to that is to be terribly hurtful and aggressive to cover.
Well, that's the amazing thing, right? Like the power we have as a partner in a love relationship is you know exactly what to say to tear that person down.
Right.
And you just choose not to because you love them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But you know.
Right.
We all know what, you know, the thing that our partner is most sensitive about.
Yeah.
And he just in that moment is so hurt that he lets that loose. And it's interesting then going through to Jason.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I remember at the time being so interested in what that pairing meant.
Yeah.
You know, because they.
It's very interesting, right? You're like Jason and Jessica. And then you're watching it going, oh my God, somehow this makes sense.
I think it makes sense. I think. You know, again, so, you know, Jason falls in love so easily, you know, and Jessica probably too, but they're probably not really suited for monogamous relationships, at least at this point in their life anyways. And yet they've both been judged, right? Jason is so heavily judged for his promiscuity and Jessica, because she's a woman, of course, is judged for that and her vampirism. And and so in a way, being able to come together and be like, hey, we're the people who everybody looks at and looks down on and thinks that we're not serious or not enough. And there's that great, I love that conversation in the Moonlight, in the sixth or seventh episode, I think sixth. It's the first time Ryan and I really have seen together, and he is so fun. He's so free. And I had so much fun that night doing that scene. It was actually warm. So we actually were like happy to just like sit out there and get to know each other better as like actors as well. And they have that conversation where, you know, he talks about how he doesn't feel special because Sookie was. And I get to say to him, how can you not think that you are special?
Right.
And then talk about how special I feel for being a vampire.
Right.
Which Hoyt cannot and does not appreciate.
Right.
At this point in time.
Right.
The resentment won't let him.
Right.
And so it is this moment for both of them to be like, we actually really like ourselves, even if no one else does, you
right.
know? And
right.
what a special bonding moment that is. I don't know. I'm so grateful for the Jessica and Hoyt storyline, and I'm so grateful for the Jessica single slash, you know, Jason storyline as well, because it just allowed so much transition and growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt that it was just written so wonderfully, because if Hoyt hadn't been cruel, we would not have been able to see you hook up with Hoyt's best friend, right? But he was cruel. And then also they put in the scene.
It's still hard.
Still hard. And then Ryan goes to Hoyt and confesses and lets him be beaten. So they were very clever. And then where you're saying to Jason, I don't want a monogamous relationship, so it's okay if we basically just have sex. And like, you know, could I even go down on you, because Hoyt was afraid of it? You know what I mean? It's like for Jason, and he's drank your blood. So all of it was orchestrated where we're like, yep, this, we see how this happened. And then we get to enjoy watching it. And it was also beautiful, beautifully shot, like really gorgeous to look at. So.
Oh, that final sex scene. Yeah.
Right.
I remember, again, another feather in Alan Ball's hat. We shot that, and I think the final cut was more explicit than they had originally thought it was going to be.
Okay.
And again, to Alan Ball's credit, this is in a pre intimacy coordinator era, right? And I felt very taken care of. Ryan is absolutely the best scene partner to have in those scenarios. Scott Winant's the best director. Ryle Tucker's the best writer. Like, very well taken care of. But Alan Ball again calls me into his office, and he says, I want you to watch this scene because it is a little more explicit than we originally had thought on the paper. And if you don't want it, you don't like it, we will fix it.
Oh my God.
Like,
gosh.
He gave me the opportunity to approve how, you know, what it was. And in the end, I did not ask to change anything, but he wanted me to see it. He wanted me to know.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
You know, had been a thing. And, you know, not that it like had violated my contract or anything like that, but it was just a little more than it was on the page. And that he was sensitive to that was so remarkable. And again, I that just feels like above and beyond, for this industry sometimes.
It is. I just keep thinking we really were ruined by doing this show.
Yeah.
We were ruined.
Well, the last thing we have to talk about before we finish this section.
Yeah.
Is, of course, the funny walks outside of Moon Goddess.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
We may have already shared this on this podcast, but we will reiterate because it is my favorite moment from this show.
Deb, I'm not sure. Have you ever laughed that hard in your life? Not just on True Blood.
In my life, no.
I think
I'm laughing too hard now. Okay.
You laughed.
I'm going to set the stage
at me. Let's be clear.
I admit I laughed at Krista Bauer. We were not laughing with her.
No.
Laughing at her.
And not only Deb, the
setting the stage.
Entire crew. Yeah, go ahead. What I saw after cut.
We're setting the stage. So we're at Moon Goddess Emporium.
Yeah.
They've got a force field up around
the storm.
Inside, they're doing magic that's going to make us all walk into the daylight force field and kill us, right?
Yeah.
So our direction is to walk like we're resisting, but we're being pulled against our will towards this force field. But somehow, I think because you had the rocket launcher, Stephen and Alex and I are all like three steps and then we're off camera. And Kristen's like 500 feet away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Easily.
So, there is
felt like
no
a thousand.
Way to do this walk elegantly in a we all looked so stupid.
Yeah.
But the three of us are like, one, two, three, turn around, yeah. Watch Kristen.
And here I am blocks away trying to figure out how to wiggle my body in a manner that shows that there's a force fucking field. How would you do this? And right before we rolled, and I sort of like, Lehman came out, Michael Lehman, our fabulous director, he came out and he goes,
"Yep,
okay, so we're going to do this and you're being pulled into the force field. So let's just try one." And I'm like looking at where my mark is and looking at where your marks are. And I went, and the fact that I didn't practice this in the mirror at home and really wishing I was someone who did my homework. Yeah. So can we all make a pact that we're not going to laugh at each other? And Stephen and Alex went,
yes, from
no.
Now on.
They were like, no way. Let's roll. I mean, they were. So what I see from my perspective, a block away, wiggling my body, like it was so ridiculous, was Alex and Stephen took 1.5 steps because he's so tall.
Yeah.
Stephen was maybe 2 steps.
Lunges.
You were like 10 steps. But the second Alex and Stephen got behind the camera, they turned around to watch me with these, like, almost like they had popcorn.
Oh, yeah. We couldn't wait. We were very excited about it. So that's our first take, which maybe got used. It's hard to know what actually ended up in the cut.
Yeah.
But I remember Lehman coming out and being like, so that's not going to work. And what we...
And he looked at me kindness. He goes, I won't use that. Because everyone's laughing. No, there's a step in between, Deb. Because then you and everyone were like, we got to watch playback. Can we watch playback? And everyone ran over to the monitor and they played it back. And everyone stood around crying, laughing at me.
Oh my God. It was the greatest moment. We needed it so bad because it was a whole week shooting that night sequence in a small town far away. So we were all staying in a hotel and getting very little sleep and doing this. So we part of how you get through these extraordinarily difficult shoot weeks is crew, cast, everyone there has to just be in on the fun and looking for it wherever we can, having a good sense of humor and a good attitude about it.
Yeah.
But I do remember eventually they did have like, a grip or somebody, they put ropes around our hips or something or our waists so that they could pull and we could resist, but still move forward. And I think that worked a lot better.
Yeah.
And they could still like remove the ropes and post or something. So I think that's what they had.
I know. And still, Deb, when I watched it and I saw, because you're on Jason. And you fang out, and then you move one leg, and then you move one arm. And I was like, brilliant, brilliant. That chick really, did she practice?
I think about these things.
And it showed, and it was great, and I was jealous all over again. That was such a fun, I loved actually all night. Of it, like being, you know, the butt of the joke. And I remember Lana, my makeup artist, coming over, and she had tears streaming in her face. She was trying to touch me up, and she was trying so hard to not laugh. And I go, you can laugh. And she said, Deb, the nicest person on earth, laughed so hard, I just had to clean up the tears on her neck. Like you had tears running down the front of your body.
It was too much.
It was amazing. But, you
know, to come full circle on this and bring this to a close, you know, I think the family nature of this, the fact that I had a scene with Stephen and you and Ryan and Alex and the others were inside. And, you know, like we were all together.
We were together.
In Bontemps Shreveport home.
Yeah.
You know, just made the secret sauce of this episode, both off camera and on.
I love the memories of the times when, and La Puente, where we shot that, it is one of my favorite memories. And when people are rewatching this episode, when we get out of the van, when we show up and get out of the van and they kind of slowed it down, I have an ego moment of how cool and badass we look as vampires together. We're in our SWAT gear. You know, another smart thing I'll just say as a last thing, but we had all these guns strapped to us. And here I am, where I've been on a lot of stuff, and Deb is new, and we do the blocking. And after we've done the master shot, where now you're stuck with what you did in the rehearsal, right. I glance over at you and you have no guns. Now, these things are heavy, and we're there for five nights. And I go, how'd you get rid of your guns? And you go, I just set them down. And you knew. I was like, this rookie, season four, is now, and then you knew how to do the funny walk. So yeah, I was like, Deb. You were like, yeah, they're heavy. I just set them down. And I had
the apprentice has become the teacher.
The apprentice, and I'm carrying those things. My shoulders are hurting for 5 days, and I was thinking about that. By the way, just I have to say, as a little aside, I mean, the Terry and Arlene, all these actors, so fabulous. I do have to just
There's so much to talk about.
We're always going to
leave people out, but holy crud, yeah.
But holy crud, and also WTF on giving them that creepy doll. Like, that is a bizarre storyline to sell. Because they,
it's my fault.
And it's your, like,
Jessica gave it to them. It's my fault. It's
a, when you were shooting the scene, you were like, really? I don't just throw this old crappy thing in the trash. I'm going to go give it to Arlene. As like, here's, I didn't go buy a Cabbage Patch doll for the kid. I bring it this thing that's like terrifying and ugly, and they keep it with.
Well, we couldn't get rid of it. So we figured better give it to a. To an infant,
yeah, exactly. It keeps coming back bizarrely, but you're like, you know what? I'll give it to someone that I like. It was just, and then they keep it with the baby no matter where the baby goes. So that, I think, is a little bit of a hard sell. But Terry and Arlene, right? Terry and Arlene just knock it out of the park.
Carrie and Todd.
Incredible. And Andy, Chris Bauer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lauren Bowles as Holly.
Oh, great.
You know, again, they're so fantastic in everything. And of course, it's just hard to fit everyone in, but we love them.
Hey, and wait a minute. Luna, our producer.
Yes, of course. We have Janina Gavankar this season.
Uh-huh.
We're going to talk to her next season.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're saving some of that for that. But duh.
Yeah, duh. I mean, that's
extraordinary.
Yeah, we're here talking about True Blood to you because of Luna.
Welcome to Kristen's Clip Corner.
Hello, friends and enemies. It's a beautiful day on the bayou. Today, we'd like to share with you a few of the snappiest, sexiest, and silliest one-liners from the hundreds we heard this season on True Blood.
I gotta say, Kristen, most of my picks are Pam.
I gotta say, most of my picks are Pam. All right, kids, feast your ears on this.
You've reached Officer Jason Stackhouse. This is emergency. Dial 911 and ask for me. Or leave a message here. Peace.
Utterly. We've loved these Wiccan dipshits already. I got a mani-pedi at 4.
I liked you better when you were brain damaged.
I know I'm a vampire, Snooki.
It's Sookie.
I know what I am.
I have to say, for a badass werewolf, you drive like a girl.
You two lovebirds go on home, okay? And let these good people practice their constitutional right to be fucking idiots.
Jesus, tits, and God, America, Jason. What the fuck is happening to me?
Over Sookie and her precious fairy vagina and her unbelievably stupid name. Fuck Sookie!
Stop saying fuck. I can't concentrate.
That's some catchy shit for your head, Stone. Good night.
So, Deb, You did some fabulous homework, and I'm realizing that I didn't, yes. I'm not even sure I Googled playing a vampire. Jeez, what's something wrong with me? I'm realizing. So, myths and lore. And you did, yes. You've got so much interesting information here. It says at the top of the outline you gave me, almost every culture on Earth has some form of myth revolving around an undead being returning in search of blood, which is actually sort of astounding.
Yes.
But the modern vampire archetype is entirely descendant of the European folklore, right? So we can focus, you are saying we can focus our thoughts. Yes. It's so sweet that you say we, because this is really you, Scully. And it is so interesting.
Yes,
and I'm grateful.
We can out me. Yeah. We can out me as the overachiever that I am. I'm also enormously geeky about lore. I really, really love the oral traditions, these stories, these superstitions that we have been telling ourselves for so long and the reasons why we tell them. So as I said, you know, again, it's a fascinating topic. There, again, every culture in the world has some form of vampire, you know, vampiric archetype. But the modern vampire that we're used to really does come from that European folklore. So we'll stick there.
So interesting.
But so we have obviously vampires. We're going to talk mostly about that, but we also have witches this season. So there's some interesting history surrounding witches. Mm-hmm. And the really interesting thing is actually going back and starting with physical evidence, right? Mm. So, you know, a lot of these things come out of unexplainable, you know, the supernatural is really just the preternatural is one thing I've heard it say. It's it's a natural occurring thing that we just don't yet have an explanation for. So we call it the supernatural. So one really interesting thing we see in the 1700s, it's called the Age of Enlightenment because we think about it as a time where we're coming out of this era of superstition and hysteria. You know, the 1600s are the witch trials and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We're leaning into science and logic. But interestingly, vampire lore takes a huge increase. There's such an increase in the incidence of vampire stories and you know, real life accusations going on during these 1700s time period. And I think it's because of physical evidence, because, you know, in the 1700s we're so obsessed with science and physical evidence, and we have physical evidence that was being misinterpreted at the time. So I want to give a little sort of warning here. If you're a fan of True Blood, you probably don't have an issue with like body gore or blood or anything like that. But we're gonna get into it here a little bit and talk about decomposing bodies. So one place where they believe the vampire myth to have arisen is a mistaken understanding about body decomposition and how that works. Now, we know today that can vary tremendously depending on, you know, when the person was buried. Was it cold or hot? What's the type of soil? Are they in a casket or not? These things can vary, you know, how a body decomposes. So when people would start to get sick in these small villages where, you know, superstition is maybe still, you know, alive. And it would be centered in families. A lot of times we're talking about pneumatic things like tuberculosis, where you become very pale and very weak and you're coughing up blood. And so you look very much like you're losing blood.
Right.
And then people start dying in these families. And the sickness can sometimes also give way to visions and dreams, just as any of us might have. You know, those kinds of reactions, and people will see their dead family members in these visions and say, they visited me in the night. So now we think, oh no, maybe we have a vampire in our midst. And also if your cattle is dying, your sheep are dying, things like that.
Right.
Okay, so now it's going to get a little bit fun and gross because we're going to talk about the bodies. So they go and they exhume these bodies. Now, the interesting thing is that some of them are going to appear very decomposed. So you go, okay, that was a, you know, normal person who died. But others, as bodies decompose, the skin pulls away from the nails. The gum line recedes around the teeth. The skin pulls away from the hair. Hair and beards appear to grow. So you see a person with long nails and long teeth and longer hair.
Right.
They also will bloat with the gases from decomposition. So a person who was quite frail in life will appear well-fed. Their skin complexion will be reddened and ruddy. Plus, the juices of the decomposing innards will start to leak from their mouth, appearing to be blood. So you see this person in a coffin that appears well-fed, dripping blood from their mouths.
Right.
And the instinct then is to stake them. And when they would do this and the gases would get released, it would push the gases past the vocal cords in the throat, creating a death moan, so that these corpses would actually gurgle, you know, with this escaping gas,
right,
which would...
Like they were just dying.
Would seem like a death thrall in that moment. And I think, again, at the time with the scientific knowledge that they had, what a terrifying experience that would be. And it would certainly seem to be evidence of something supernatural occurring.
Yeah, when you have nothing scientifically to explain even a disease that could be contagious, you have no understanding of any of these processes, the mind is going to try to come up with and fill in that huge gap.
Yes, that blank. And we have, you know, infectious disease experts writing papers on certain cases. You know, famous ones are Mercy Brown and Blagojevich, and, you know, these people you can look up where they have actual experts, government people. In fact, the government executed or exhumed bodies and investigated vampires throughout this century, which is fascinating that it leads so much credence to that. You know, another common issue that they had at the time because of poorly diagnosing was burying people alive. Comas. You know, just non-responsiveness was a thing, and it was hard to diagnose. And so sometimes they would open coffins to find claw marks, or people had tried to, you know, bite their way out. It was kind of a thing. In fact, it became later on in the years became such a scary thing, this idea of being buried alive, that a device called Benson's Belfry was developed, which is essentially a little bell on a string that goes all the way down into the coffin. So that if
oh my
you
god,
wake
what
up,
if the string broke?
Little bell.
Like you'd be ringing that bell so hard if you came to, and then the string breaks.
Well, honestly, more often than not, because it wasn't like a common occurrence, more often than not, bells would ring because of the wind or, you know, earth tremors. And then all these people are being unburied kind of for no reason. So, you know, it's a wild, wild time. And so many of these vampiric folkloric tales, are often attributed to these, you know, misunderstanding of nature and how that works.
I think it's interesting. I always think of when I hear stories like this, or I realize that we think now we're at the cutting edge and we know everything, but they thought that
so
then.
Did they.
So we're having these explanations for what's happening.
Yes.
In the same way, it's good to remember that we're filling those gaps for what we don't know. And what we don't know about embodied life is about all of it. So,
And then I think also, you know, the other layer to put on that historically is that, of course, we are talking about extreme prejudice. You know, we're talking about times where, you know, accusations are thrown based on very little except dislike and distrust. So we go back, we look at something like the Salem witch trials, and we see that, you know, at this time, it's fairly common. It's one of the most sort of notorious witch trials, although it was by no means unique. It had been going on for centuries before then. So these young girls were having fits of like supernatural intensity, and no doctors could explain bodily why this was happening. And as they increase, they started to accuse local women of being witches. Now, these are, of course, based on gender, but also race, religious adherence, if you were not a very good Christian, class, and then often just personal feuds.
Wow. And
all of these things then get people accused and put on trial. And the trials were renowned for the use of spectral evidence, which is essentially just testimony from the victims claiming to have seen apparitions of the witches. Fascinating. I mean, out of all of this, I mean, and really quite terrible. I mean, with the Salem witch trials alone, I think over 200 people were accused.
Oh my
30
God.
Were found guilty and 19 were executed, five more of those dying in jail. And the cool little tidbit that you picked out of my notes is that among the 19 executed, two were dogs.
Two dogs!
Accused of witchcraft.
Now I'm really mad.
You know, the other things, there's also, you know, as we go back and look at these things, that, you know, obviously, as you said, extreme prejudice, as well as hysteria and potentially a need for attention for these young girls, and stress is a lot of what came into it. However, they have also done some research and discovered that they were all the grain of choice was rye. And at the time, there was an infestation of a fungus on this rye, and the fungus is the base substance in LSD. So there is even a possibility that some of that was working on these young women. So, it's, you know, who knows? It's a combination of a lot of things, but they all come together to create this, you know, really terrifying situation.
So fascinating.
But it's interesting because I think we look at Antonia, you know, and I think True Blood is doing a really good job then of saying, here's the history and the hysteria, but what if it's also real, but they still shouldn't be persecuted? You know, and it's just a really nice way to kind of bring both the history and the reality, as well as the fun supernatural element, and actually have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, the writers, I think, always from their own lives and perspective, and they're just really interesting people, do such a good job of exactly what you just said, is making the supernatural kind of a way for us to examine these human traits that are not so fabulous. Yeah. And it's still happening today, right? Our prejudices with social media, and we just don't like someone, and cancel culture, whatever. These things build steam in the same way, the exact same way that they did with the witch trials.
Yeah. And well, that is a perfect example of one of the, again, more notorious vampire figures in history, which was Elizabeth Bathory. So this is 1600 Hungary. She was accused of torturing and killing hundreds of girls and women between 1590 and 1610. She was accused, the stories are, that she created a courtly etiquette school for the, you know, girls, the daughters of lesser gentry. They could come to her school, learn how to be courtly women, and therefore secure a better match, which was the only way to survive as a woman at the time. But these girls never came home, or if they were found, they were dead with weird markings on them. And so she was accused of torturing and killing them, and then bathing in their blood to remain young forever. Now, here's the interesting pieces that come out as we look back on this, right?
Yeah.
So one thing we learned is that as a child, Elizabeth Bathory had seizures, possibly epilepsy. And the current treatment for epilepsy at that time was to rub the blood of a non-sufferer on the lips of the epileptic. Young age, she's potentially being taught that other people's blood is healing. Beyond that, there is no evidence other than testimonial evidence that this is true, that she did any of this at all. No one ever filed a complaint before her arrest, but of course, after her arrest, they have over 300 testimonials about this. Now, again, we're talking about spectral evidence. We're talking about hearsay. You know, we just know back then the kind of torture and forced confessions and things that, you know, could happen at that time. And you start to look at her, She was quite a wealthy noblewoman. She married someone very wealthy. And when he died, she gained tremendous influence in this area. And the man who was assigned to be her sort of guardian was the lead investigator in this trial. So that to me seems like a conflict of interest.
That might be a little conflict.
So again, to me, it's that perfect example of the reality of what's going on and, you know, the stored fantasy that we make up around it. And I think to link back to True Blood, we see that a lot. You know, what's really going on, the politics of something and the prejudices involved versus the true story.
Yep. And all of that is all happening today, and then it just looks different, but I sure am glad I live now.
Next week on Truest Blood, we are wrapping up the season with the Fiona Shaw. I am so excited. She is a powerhouse of the stage and screen, an idol of mine, and it is just a pleasure to hear her share her experience.
And you have all seen her. We've all been watching her perform for decades. Especially, right? We all know her as Petunia Dursley in Harry Potter. This interview is not to be missed.
So thanks for listening, Truvies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now, you hear.
Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on Max.